All right, welcome everybody. I'm Flash McVeigh, co-host with Rain Waters on the Afterburn podcast. We're coming at you with another episode. Today we have an incredible guest. I've been looking forward to this one for a while. Got referred to this guest by a buddy of mine, Kelso Flick. And today we got Brigadier General retired Max Stiffy Stitzer. So first off, sir, and Stiffy, welcome to the pod.
Oh, thanks. So excited for this opportunity.
Yeah, no, we're excited to have you. So wide-ranging career. We're going to start this off by tell us about yourself. By the way, before we get started, Stiffy, maintenance officer by trade, prior enlisted, myself, a fighter pilot. We're going to attempt to get through this hour-long conversation without fighting each other or arguing over code threes. Is going to be the goal of the day. So I think we can probably make that happen. But in all seriousness, Stiffy, go ahead. Tell us about yourself. Tell us kind of your experiences, your career, any of your favorite assignments or anything like that. But over to you.
Yeah, good. I never fought with any of my aviator buddies over hardware. It was always over the flying hour program and the schedule.
Oh man.
So as long as we steer clear of FHP, we're good.
Oh, one of our very favorite topics is FHP on this show.
Actually, I have thoughts, so we'll talk about that. If there's time or opportunity, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting. This is not the beginning. I'll kind of back up and start at the beginning, but the tail end of my enlisted time, I cross-trained and I was a one Charlie Oscar in a fighter squadron, in the world's greatest fighter squadron, in fact, you may or may not be assigned to. And that was just, you know, my first few years in intelligence as a target intel person, which is not an enlisted career field anymore in our Air Force, was just the best foundation for everything that I was going to do for the next four decades. But I had no idea that was the case. That was what I signed up for. But again, we'll back up and talk about how I landed there. But to go from being a one Charlie Oscar and an ops tech into being a maintenance officer, I knew the ops side of how the flying hour program was built, how scheduling happened, how events mattered to fighter pilots in a fighter squadron, all the training and the syllabus and stand eval and, you know, scheduling and operations and training and all of those functions in a fighter squadron. And so it made me a really good lethal maintenance officer because I didn't have to be trained. I just got to train my ops brothers and sisters on maintenance. And I was good at that and able to communicate with them because I came from their tribe and knew their language and what mattered to them. And was able to teach maintainers about that as well. So I never presumed I was, you know, special or better than anybody else. But in that regard, man, no other maintainer knew those kind of things like I did. So it was it made us a really effective team with ops and maintenance, which is all you ever want or need, right? To go, that's right, go downrange and take the grip of the enemy. Yeah. So, I have Air Force service and military service in my heritage for sure. Generations of ancestors were in the military. My mom's dad was a World War II enlisted flyer in the Army Air Forces. He was a flying radio man and crew chief on C-46s and C-47s, flying over the hump, the China Burma India Theater. And of all the, you know, the grandkids, uncles, nephews, everybody else in the family, I was the only one that showed an interest and heard his war stories from World War II. And that the background of that was while he was a depot mechanic, a wage grade mechanic at Hill Air Force Base, working on F-4s and J-79s. And so he took me to all the air shows, to the Hill Air Force Base Museum, once there was one a little later in my childhood. And that was the biggest inspiration to help me decide that I was going to join the Air Force. And so I drove towards high school graduation as a pretty average student. I was really smart and I did well in the stuff I liked and cared about and disregarded all the stuff that I probably needed the most of, but didn't like. But you know, as a new 18-year-old in February of my graduation year of high school, I had really long hair. I wanted to play bass guitar in a rock band and drag race. And that was the extent of my vision of the future. And my dad came to me in my bedroom one day and said, put that stupid bass guitar down. Nobody's ever going to pay to hear you play, you know, an instrument on stage, but you are going to have to figure out what you're going to do with your life. And he gave me two suggestions. And one of those was the military. And to me, that sounded like the easier choice, actually, of the two. And so I started ringing up recruiters and talking to them. And I talked to all the recruiters, all the services. My best friend actually lived next door to a Marine recruiter, and he joined the Marine Corps Reserve. And I said, man, I already decided the military kind of sounded like the harder option, but I was going to do it anyway, but I was not going to join the Marine Corps. And thankfully that's the case. And so, you know, much later on in life and my professional career, in joint assignments, I worked for and with great U.S. Marines, and certainly love and appreciate them and all the other services. But I picked the right career field for sure, and certainly the right color uniform. So the Air Force Reserve recruiter sat down with him, and he showed me all of the career options. And I looked and I said, it sounds like you're trying to get me to do all the things that I get a bonus for, which means you get a bonus for. And they offer, I was smart enough at 18 to know they give bonuses for a reason. It's because the stuff people don't want to do as much, right? They have a harder time filling, and there must be a reason for that. And not to disparage what any of those other career fields or specialties are, but on another list, he had a list that required an interview. And on that list was intelligence. And I said, well, I've debated and done, you know, debate events in high school and done really well. And so I think I can brief and talk and learn and, you know, do things like that. I think that's what I'm interested in. And he said, well, those are really tough interviews. I don't recommend it. And I said, well, why don't we give it a shot there?
No, we'll give it a shot.
Their master sergeant.
How about you just let me try?
And so we marched over. And the Air Reserve technician, the full-time intel officer in that squadron, was a Vietnam vet, former master sergeant, who was then a captain. And he looked like a nice guy, but also like a no BS kind of guy. And I was a little intimidated. It wasn't like a high school teacher or something like that, you know. And so he parked me in front of his desk and interviewed me. And he said, I think we'll take you. We'll give you a shot. You got the stuff. And as I reflect back now, how I look at kids that age who probably looked a lot like I did, and there's no good reason he picked me. I'm not sure I presented any of the things he needed to see in that interview, but for some reason he took a chance on me. And you know, it was during the Cold War. We were flush with people, like a typical Air Force Reserve unit. There was a list of people lined up to get in the unit, but they were all prior service. And so a brand new airman off the street who had to go to basic training and tech school and everything didn't really take a position away from any of those fully qualified people. So off I went, and I immediately knew I wanted to be in uniform and do that as a full-time career my whole life. Which was not necessarily conducive to being the reservist I signed up to be, so I could stay in my hometown and go to college, you know, where I was born and where I lived. So I did every bit of full-time military duty on orders. I took every TDY, every great trip for years and years. And finally, the second guy who replaced that captain went to me and he said, you know, I need to love and idolize these fighter pilots, and they've expressed their support for you to come, you know, graduate college and come back and fly in this squadron. But he said, there's a distinct difference between you and them. They finished college. So you need to get your butt in gear, quit taking all these good deal trips and knuckle down in school and finish and get a degree. And so I heard that edict loud and clear, and he was right, of course. And the guy was like Combat Bob. I don't know if you've heard of him, but like a second dad to me, and still is to this day. Also a Vietnam vet, which is a trend. I was raised by Vietnam vets at that time in the early 80s, the Cold War. So set about to finish college. My last semester of college, I came up needing glasses. And in those years, the early 90s, they weren't waiving anything. for any reason because they had far more applicants than they could take to go fly. So I said, you know, my what I really want to do is make a difference and lead airmen and make the mission happen. So my very next choice, and it was a very close second choice, was to be an aircraft maintenance and munitions officer. And that's what I got to go do. So that just launched me into a whole career. And I recognized pretty soon after that, that I was exactly where I needed to be. And again, no disrespect, but from my perspective, if I'd been a pilot, I'd have been one dude in a cockpit who was kind of a customer of all of the support that makes the mission happen. And as a maintenance officer, I got to lead hundreds of people immediately who made the mission happen. And so I felt like I had an opportunity to have a lot bigger impact. And I probably would have been a terrible pilot. I probably wouldn't have had the hands and the brain for it. I certainly didn't have the vision for it. And so there are ways that you end up, you know, whether you believe there's a spiritual component or whatever, or the institution kind of drove you to the right place. But I ended up exactly where I needed to be. And I think the fact that in the end that I ended up as a general officer kind of shows that that was the right path, because the odds of starting where I did and ending where I did are absolutely astronomical. And they are multiples of astronomical if I'd been a rated officer, right? Because there's far more competition and just the math wouldn't have been nearly as favorable to me. So it all worked out in the end. But man, that took me through 4 decades from an airman in a fighter squadron, taking out the trash and washing and detailing the soft truck and printing hard copies of the flying schedule, to being a general on the air staff and the joint staff in the Pentagon. And I pinched myself every day, especially the 7.5 years that I spent in 2 tours in the Pentagon. I started out as an intel airman reading Tom Clancy novels, and I got to live it for 4 decades. But I joke to people, you know, they're like, how, I want to be like you, how did you end up like that? And I said, well, there's a chance you can, because the competition is weak and the standards are very low. And that's why I got where I did.
No, I like what you said. Like, well, I think I'm very important as a fighter pilot. We talk very routinely on this show and on this podcast about the fact that it's like I'm the last part of the kill chain and potentially the least critical. Is obviously I'm not in the target area without a working airplane, without qualifications and somebody tracking those, and all the schools and the intelligence on what the target is and things like that. So the people that support the fighter pilot, I have an immense amount of respect for, and then an immense amount of respect for your 40-year career. I'm gonna cherry pick one, something you said about being in the world's greatest fighter squadron, the 466, which I am a part of now. So in the house of that. But AMOS or AMOS, AMOS, AMOS?
AMOS, yeah.
Okay, so Advanced Maintenance and Munitions Operator School. I went to the fighter weapons school, graduated from there. So we both wear, this super cool patch on our left shoulder for our career talk. Can you tell us what that kind of is, like maintenance weapons school?
Yeah. So my graduation certificate's right above my head on the back wall there. And, I'm very proud. And if you can see it, there's 2 patches there. One is the patch at the time of what was then known, after that first class, as the AEF Logistics School. So AEFLS, it wasn't AMOS yet. The patch on the other side is the weapons school patch. And I think it's an instructor patch too, right? It's got the black border on it. So when my wing commander, who nominated me at the time down at the 301st Fighter Wing in Fort Worth, was Tommy Dykes. Tommy Dykes is a legend. If you don't know that name, look it up. Delta Yankee Charlie Hotel Echo Sierra. There's a book called Sierra Hotel, The Era of Fighter Pilots After Vietnam. And it's about the contemporaries of Tommy Dykes, who came home from Vietnam and said, no more Vietnams, right? We're going to retool our Air Force. We're going to take over from the bomber generals and the mobility airlift generals, and retool how we do things in the Air Force so we can fight and win wars, which we did under their leadership. Tommy Dykes is mentioned in that book. So as a captain in Vietnam flying F-100s, He was a contemporary of people like Dick Myers and John Jumper and other incredible names like that. You know, Dick Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when he retired. Yeah. And Tommy Dykes actually retired as his two-star reserve assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So that's where he ended up. Anyway, he signed my nomination to go to the very first class of Amos, believing it was weapon school, that it was WIC, just like he helped found for F4s and you know, was a legend in that community. And so when I came back, he said, "Where's your patch, bud?" And I said, "Well, see, here's the thing. They're not giving patches because it's not really part of weapons school, you know, this whole thing, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Well, I'll be damned. I sent you to weapons school. You're a weapons school grad." And he gave me his patch, ripped it off his shoulder. And so I framed it when I framed my certificate. Subsequently, a few years down the road, you know, it was my good fortune to be an OG from that very first class. And a few years down the road, they got a patch, and then they actually got a patch with a target, the bomb hitting the target, the normal weapon school patch, and it just says Amos on it instead of weapon school. But that single event of all, if I had to pick one, is the biggest windfall in my professional career because of what I learned there, what I learned about myself more than anything. I didn't learn a lot of content that was new, but how to apply it and how to be an integrator. And it, you know, literally says that on my graduation certificate, that's your responsibility, right? And then to be humble, credible, and approachable, and to be an instructor and an advisor and produce air power. And they've held to that mantra. And we just celebrated our 20th anniversary last spring, just last week, I guess, a year ago, of the 20th anniversary of our graduation. And I was the first in everything coming out of that school, first squadron commander, first group commander, first colonel, first general officer, as an Amos grad. And so that association's been very dear. There was a time things changed over the last few years as I got busier, but for many, many years, I went to more graduations than I missed. And helped shepherd that school through and got to be a voice just because of my, you know, the good fortune of my seniority and when I went through so early. And one of the first commandant who's in the picture on that under that certificate with me is now an undersecretary of defense for sustainment, Steve Marani. So again, prior service enlisted civil engineer guy who ended up as an aircraft maintenance officer and was the first commandant of U.S. Air Force Amos, another pillar in that community who mentored me and who I got to, you know, associate with for a long time. People like that who I ran into, I wouldn't have gotten anywhere near what I did professionally had I not been mentored and had the great example of people like that. So that's a trend for me in my life for sure.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, like the Amos grads that I've been a part of. I actually, to be perfectly honest with you, like I don't think I've been in a unit that hasn't had like a really amazing OIC, superintendent, chief pro super, all those different things. But like when I run into a guy with a weapon school patch, which I truly look at it as a weapon school patch, is there's always something just a little bit different. And it's whether that they just get it a little bit more, or they just are. Or there's like, nope, I am the master integrator of my community, and things like that. That I've been blown away by pretty much every Amos grad that I've run into throughout my career, being a part of it. Like as with OICs, about three or four of them that I've seen. So wanted to kind of talk about that as well, because I know Rain is also having like a weapon school thing.
Yeah, you've got three in your wing right now who I had a personal hand in there. Development, right? So a captain, a chief, and a colonel, including your maintenance group commander, colonel.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.
And so Kermit, I raised Kermit up from a staff sergeant, got him commissioned there at Hill. He moved around and did all the tough jobs and then has ended up back there as a maintenance group commander. Extremely proud of him. And that's the greatest pride I have in anything I accomplished in my career are the folks I helped raise up behind me. So I feel like I more than replaced myself.
And that's kind of like the weapon school. I mean, aside from humble, approachable, credible, the other, if you were to say a motto of the weapon school is make one more. And so Pretty much when you're looking at that is you've made many more. So you make one more, you made that one, you make the next one. And I know that a lot of us look at going to weapons school as not about us. It's now about serving other people. It sounds like you were of the same ilk as you've gone through your career. All right, let's talk Pentagon. Is it as awful of a building as it's made out to be?
You know, it's interesting. People always want to know about that because most people haven't been there, certainly haven't served there. So you see and hear what's on the news and what, you know, is kind of urban legend about being in the Pentagon and serving in Washington, D.C. And one thing I always say, I always lead off saying it's an honor to be asked to serve at that level. There are many staff jobs, not all of them, but many who they don't necessarily get the best people or who you'd want there. You get the person who nobody else wants or who is too dumb to jink out of a staff assignment, right? It's funny because it's true, right? It's a little different in my experience at the Pentagon. The two places I served, my first tour, as a two-time graduated maintenance group commander, I got called up to go to the Joint Staff J4, so the Directorate for Logistics, in 2014. Really important time up there. In the building for sure. And so that was a quantum leap from being very tactical, even though you're, you know, an 06 and a maintenance group commander. And I was at March at the time with two incredible MDSs, two weapon systems, KC-135s and C-17s. But after only 15 months in that job, they called and said, here's your next assignment. You're going to the Pentagon. And I knew, first of all, that was an amazing opportunity. And second, it meant that they probably had plans for me, you know, for further development and potential beyond colonel. So it was easy to say yes, tough to leave getting paid to live and work in Southern California for sure. And being with 1,100 amazing airmen every single day to going and being on a staff and having a cubicle. But it was immediately apparent that was a huge opportunity. The Joint Staff handpicked every person from every service, at least in J4 where I was, but I got the sense that was the case in the 3, the 5, the 8, you know, and so on, everybody I associated with. So they were very deliberate in who they develop and send there. But you can't escape the politics because you work for civilian leadership at some level. They may be one or two degrees of separation, but everybody in uniform works for ultimately somebody who's not in uniform. And so that was a great learning opportunity for me to see what you hear about, to see it up close and personal. And, you know, the administration that was in office in 2014 was different than the others. I mean, I've been in since Reagan, right? Joined the Air Force in 1984. So served under every commander in chief for, again, nearly 40 years and several administrations. But no matter what, the people in uniform supersede any politics, any partisan activities or anything like that. I mean, in uniform, we're famously apolitical and nonpartisan, right? And so we recognize, we swear an oath to the Constitution, which is not a person or a party. it's a constitution and a set of ideals that govern our great republic. Yeah. And, but again, you can't escape the influence of the politicians and the political appointees and the people they hire. And, it wasn't as widely used at the time, but the term deep state was known. And, I began to see and understand what that meant. And it's not this nefarious conspiracy theory thing. There actually is a permanent administrative state in Washington, D.C. So people apply and become civil servants, and that's something they want to do with their life and professional career. But some are also put in place by the political appointees because they're political, because they subscribe to certain politics or policies or, you know, priorities or everything. And then when that administration and the political appointees leave office, those people stay and they do things their way according to their politics and their, you know, their philosophy and everything. So it's not this, you know, hillbilly redneck accusation that there's a deep state. There's a deep state. There are people who stay beyond successive political administrations, and they don't necessarily subscribe to the policies of the administration that they're currently under because they were there before they were elected and in office. And so when you hear, you know, the wives' tales or whatever you want to call them about civil servants and you can't fire them and everything, that's largely true. It's difficult to fire a civil servant, and especially in Washington, D.C., because Washington, D.C. is a few things. There's a saying that Washington, D.C. or national politics is Hollywood for ugly people. I can confirm that's true. And that it's that Washington, D.C. is a town full of lawyers. That's also true. And that it's a town of student body presidents, right? So that same, those people who are, you know, just kind of strivers and very, very public and you know, strive for accolades and to make a difference in everything. That's Washington, D.C. So everybody's got an agenda, except for the most part, as it should be, the people in uniform. They're good servants to the Constitution, to their fellow airmen, sailors, soldiers, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, Space Force Guardians, just doing the job, recognizing they've worked for one administration and they'll work for this one and they'll work for the next and hold the line. But the politics certainly are the most unsatisfying part of living there, other than the practical things like the cost and the crowds and the traffic and things like that, that really don't have much to do with politics. But people would come to me in that first tour. I was the deputy to an SES, the lone SES in J4, who was also a retired Air Force two-star, had been a bomber pilot and a mobility pilot. I got to be his deputy, and that dude was high energy. He think Ross Perot with maybe better manners and a little bit better looking, right? super amazing guy to work for. But he gave the staff under him a hard time because he was so high energy. The young uniformed officers couldn't keep up with him. And so he really was a force of nature. So I got to be that buffer because I was his deputy and I was still in uniform, and helped people understand how he operated and what his perspective was. And so I loved him and was fiercely loyal to him and learned as much from him as any boss ever. And then I got to translate that into more palatable orders and priorities for the field grade officers below us in our directorate. And people would come to me and say, how can you be so calm and how can you just brush some of this stuff off? And I said, because first of all, it's mostly transitory. Something that spins up and catches your attention and frustrates people today, we won't even care about tomorrow. So, you know, learn what matters and what doesn't and let it go. And then I would also tell them that our tour here, even though it was an honor to be there and I worked with amazing people, it was still a tax on your career before then, when you got to work at the tactical level and do all the fun work while somebody just like us now was doing these same jobs 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. So we could have the force we do today, the funding we have, the budget we have, the policy, the TTPs, you know, whatever, somebody built those and we just got to operate under them and play in them and do the tactical warfighter jobs. And now we're providing for a generation or two in the future by doing those jobs now. And they could ask anybody and they asked us.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting because like a lot of the guys that I know that have gone to the Pentagon and been on staff, they talk about that every day is just a new crisis. And like everything is so high energy, so high strung that nothing falls below the cut line. I'm just like, guys, that's going to be a long game. We don't have to really focus on that just right now. But the kind of the thing in prioritization, but everything is a crisis every day and people treat them all as such. And that was like kind of an interesting thing that I've heard from a lot of folks and from a guy who's been in the building, trying to tamp that down as a higher level person in a directorate, seems to be just a fact of life, inside of the building.
Yeah. And it is true. And I came to recognize as a colonel in the Pentagon, colonels run the Pentagon. So certainly there are a lot of high ranking people and a lot of higher ranking people than colonels, but the work really gets done at the colonel and action officer level. And then the people above them lead those efforts and talk about it for the most part. I had a boss who told me, he said, when you come to the Pentagon as an 06, that really means you're two 03s strapped together in afterburner. That's the kind of productivity we expect. And it was true. So what you offer different than a junior officer is wisdom and a worldview and maturity. And you've been conditioned through successive layers of command and leadership that, you know, you're not overreactive. Hopefully you're the right personality and temperament when you get to that level, but that you maintained captain energy. Right. And so that was, you know, I had the opportunity to teach and mentor people, and not just airmen, but from all services. And I'll tell you, every service brought their very best to those jobs and gave me a great deal, incredible respect for how all the other services develop and fight. And, you know, we fight and win as a joint force. So there's no such thing as an Air Force only fight or a Navy only fight or whatever. And you certainly, you know, we can't survive a day without space. And what they provide, the umbrella over all of it. Space is obviously recognized now as its own proper warfighting domain, and we've organized around that accordingly. That was an interesting thing. If I can, you know, if I kind of take a sidetrack for a second. So my second tour in the Pentagon, back on the air staff as the director of staff for A4. So the director for logistics, engineering, and force protection for the Air Force, the deputy chief of staff. I was his director of staff as a new one star. And Space Force happened. So December 2019, when the NDAA was finally signed, it enacted the Space Force. And it actually surprised the DOD and the Department of the Air Force, because the anticipation was Congress is going to pass this thing and enact a Space Force. And then they'll say, you know, 12 or 24 months from now, have stand up a force. And the language actually ended up that on December 20th, 2019, there was a U.S. Space Force. And so on that day, there was one member of the Space Force, four-star general, right? General Raymond. And we had to create an entire service from scratch, from whole cloth, because Congress didn't do what we expected. And so I got to see that and be part of it. And that was a really exciting historical moment, because nobody alive has stood up a separate new armed force since the Air Force in 1947. So there was no textbook or TTPs on how to do that. They did it really well. And the natural tendency would have been to say, hey, now we have a Department of the Air Force, just like we have a Department of the Navy with two armed services under it, an Air Force and a Space Force, just like we have a U.S. Navy and a U.S. Marine Corps under a single service secretary, the Secretary of the Navy. We did it differently for the Space Force. Some things work really well, at the department level for two services, and some things we absolutely didn't want to lift from them, and so we didn't. And so I got to be in on that as a staff guy, and I was actually briefly, as they were trying to decide what the Space Force S4, not the A4, but the S4 in the Space Force at the headquarters level would look like, I was briefly considered to be that person. Until they decided it wasn't going to be a uniformed position. It's an SES position. Yeah. But because, you know, there are only so many general officer positions, all of ours in the Air Force were full of Air Force people doing Air Force work. But because I was a reserve officer, I was a spare, I was a utility player and could have potentially gone and done that. Would have been an honor. I'm glad I didn't. And I certainly understand why that didn't come to fruition, but in the end I'm an airman and I'm glad I got to stay and finish out in the Air Force. But it's interesting, back to the politics, because I think the prevailing narrative for Americans is that the Space Force is Trump's Space Force, right? That he created. It happened during his administration. But you got to read the Constitution. The president, the executive branch, can't create an armed force, can't fund an armed force, can't organize them, can't say how much manning they get or anything like that. That is wholly Congress's responsibility. And so Congress, as representatives of the people, recognized that space is a warfighting domain, and to compete with our enemies and our adversaries in that domain, we need a separate service to do that. And so, you know, the narrative says that politics drove that, and there's still a lot of disparagement that Space Force isn't needed, that Trump made that up for self-aggrandizement or whatever, but it was actually overdue by the time Trump was in office, and certainly has superseded him being in office. And I mean, you know, time will tell, and history will prove it was the right decision and that we were too late doing it, but it was politics that held it up. And politics that determined that actually happened during Trump's administration.
Yeah, like how the message comes out about a separate Space Force is interesting, has been interesting to me. When, I mean, we have Space Command, we have all the things that were always under the United States, the U.S. Air Force, and then that was the politics, and the message gets lost for the fact that, at least in my experience, that everybody in uniform was just like, no, this is a good thing. Yeah. And like, this is a long overdue thing that it wasn't necessarily just President Trump's like thing that he thought about last night that we just kind of needed at the time.
Yeah. But it's interesting. And I think that narrative was shaped in no small part by the Netflix series Space Force, right? With Steve Carell. That came out just before.
Don't discount the power of Netflix and mainstream media and how that plays.
And it was, I mean, that, you know, if you watch that series, whoever wrote that, man, they had some significant insights into military culture and everything, because it was it was too painfully funny, some of the things that they talked about. And my kids and wife had a heyday with it, because dad was a general in the Pentagon at the time. And they said, you're Steve Carell. That's you, you know? So I guess, like a lot of people, they thought I was a prune too, you know? So, but it was,
Hey, might have helped fun, your, funny might have your street cred around the house.
There you go.
All right. I know you're a busy man. You got some stuff going. You got some stuff going on. I want to shift a little bit. So towards the end of your career, working in plans and policy and all that different stuff, is you started talking about, and how does the Air Force transition from the global war on terror, getting out of Afghanistan, doing all these different things, and then reorganizing, reoptimizing, retooling, whatever word you want to use, for kind of this great power competition that we're looking at, and the pacing threats and the national defense strategy of trying to shift towards China, Russia, and all these different things with great power competition. And how are we going to do that and retool and reshape the military, not just the Air Force, but the Department of Defense writ large? Take us through that time, and then just your thoughts on how we're doing or how things are going, and just your insight on how that time kind of went inside the building.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple things. I appreciate that question. I care a lot about it and talk a lot about it too. So again, I'll jump back to my first exposure at that strategic level on the joint staff in 2014. There's not much we know about, from my perspective at least, that we know about China today in 2024 that wasn't known or predicted in 2014. All the warnings were there, and the warnings were diligently being transmitted across the interagency to the executive branch and to Congress by the intel community and the military, right? Department of Defense. But there was, again, political barriers to acting on that with the urgency that we knew we needed to even in 2014. And we continued to be distracted by wars in the CENTCOM AOR. And so, you know, if you can kind of illustrate what in 2014, what we thought China's trajectory would be as a near, then we only said near peer adversary and advancing at that point. So if we presumed that their vector would kind of be a 45 degree angle in development, in advancing the size of their force, the technology that their force had, their influence around the globe and everything. If we thought it was a straight line in 2014, by the time I got back to the Pentagon, the Air Staff in 2019, they had taken full advantage of our distractions, I'll call them, in CENTCOM, and had gone geometric. So instead of a straight 45-degree line, they were going asymptotic as far as their development, and especially the mass that they were developing. And so, you know, for the most part, and I mean, this is obviously open source info, they don't have technological superiority, but they certainly have mass, and they've certainly placed themselves strategically around the entire planet on continents that they were never in, and places where they're overtaking our presence and our influence for sure. South America, Africa, in some cases, even Europe. For sure, because they watched what we were doing. Our playbook was open to them while we fought in CENTCOM and were distracted against pretty low-tech threats over there. And, you know, for political reasons, largely, they took full advantage of that. They are strategically patient and very shrewd, and they've got a plan like we don't. And some of our... I don't want to call them liabilities. I can't think of the right word for it. But, you know, I love and treasure our form of government, our constitution, the fact that we're a representative republic, and how we do things and how we treat people, ourselves and other nations and everything. There's never been a better force for good than the United States in this world, and never will be. But because of that, because of this, you know, that our democracy and our desire for, you know, inclusion and fairness and things like that. We have fairness in contracting laws and federal acquisition regulations and everything. And so it takes us decades to iterate and to field technology, you know, so 40 years in between major fighter aircraft buys, 70 years in between major bomber aircraft purchases, acquisitions, and, you know, and on and on and on. You can look. That's true of the Navy and most of the other services as well. China, on the other hand, as our true pacing threat, they don't have a constitution. They've effectively nationalized their industry. And so if, in fact, a Chinese defense industry or contractor isn't nationalized, it effectively is, because you don't want to cross the Chinese Communist Party leadership. And they have, you know, plants who are board members in all the companies and everything. So if China says, hey, we want the next sixth generation fighter, they go build it. They don't have to wait and get a part built in every state to get every congressman and senator's vote to advance this program and to get the funding for it. And then to go through our Byzantine and arcane contracting processes and acquisition and all the milestones and everything like that. They can iterate much faster. We had during, again, my time in Air Force A4 in the previous administration, we had an assistant secretary of the Air Force for acquisition technology and logistics, Dr. Will Roper. And he put forth the concept of a digital century series. So he said, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we had the Century Series fighters, and we had a new model of fighter aircraft coming out every couple of years, right? Yeah. And we would build them at scale and fill them at scale and use them and everything, and then retire them as needed and move on to the next one. And each one had technical advantages over the last generation. And that's how we went from second to third to fourth generation fighters in the Air Force. Now look how far it's been since we've gone from fourth to fifth gen, and look how long it'll be from fifth to sixth gen. So he really was on to something, but the political headwinds for that from the defense contractors and just the lack of awareness and bandwidth for Congress to even recognize the goodness and truth in that and then to act on it didn't happen in time before he went out of office in the change of administration. And so that concept was ash canned, you know, it's gone away. Nobody talks about it anymore. So here we are still behind schedule on the amazing F-35. People ask about that all the time. Oh my gosh, what about the F-35? We can't build them fast enough. They're too expensive. And I say both things are true. In a system that worked and was fully functional, we would have the F-35 we need. They'd all be built and fielded by now. Would have been years ago. Wouldn't have taken as long to get the small relative numbers that we have now. But it really, in the end, it's politics and economics and the influence of the military-industrial complex that has held us up. It's not the recognition that we need that exquisite capability. And we've never had a fighter or a weapon system as amazing as the F-35. It's exactly what we need. We're on track to continue to develop and increase the capability that they have. But we're so far behind on building up that mass that we need that China doesn't have the same challenge.
Yeah. I think like the thing that at my level that I kind of talk about and then just sitting around with the guys is like, you said liability or anything like that, but it's just like, it's almost like now I think it's a good thing that our system is inefficient. And like when you're looking at it, it's like, it's like, what would you trade? Would you trade max efficiency to be more like the Chinese way of nationalizing the industry base? Or would you have our inefficient republic? And we could talk for hours on that. And so it sounds like you were kind of sensing the same thing. And then, so overall, like when we were looking at that pivot, is that like with this kind of thing, like, are we on the like right track, parallel track, wrong track, or things like that that you kind of witnessed when you were in, and then now just your thought looking back on things, because hindsight is usually a little bit better sight than foresight. So when we look at that, it's like, what do you think?
Yeah, we're behind where we should be in 2024 for sure as a nation and as a military. And again, I attribute it mostly to politics. It's not the good work of the people in uniform. You know, certainly there are some, you know, some flawed and inefficient people. They're by far the minority of our force in uniform. The people who choose to serve are led by America's best, and they are truly the treasure of this nation. They're America's sons and daughters, and everybody I've ever known in any sort of leadership position understands that and understands the responsibility we have to care for those people who have consented to wear the uniform and raise their hand and serve with us. So our barriers are largely political, and our lethargy and inertia is largely political and economic, not because we don't have the awareness we need to, and not because we haven't provided the best military advice to the executive branch and to Congress. It's a bandwidth issue and a politics and votes issue that they choose what they act on and what they don't, and what they fund and what they don't. And, you know, you talked about the velocity thing in Washington. I think that's a universal criticism, right? Nothing happens in Washington. Congress doesn't, never produces anything. And there's actually data to show during this current Congress, they've produced a tiny fraction of the legislation that previous Congresses have, you know, in number of bills and legislation and things like that. I happen to be a small government person, so I don't think more laws and more legislation is necessarily a good thing or a better thing at all. But when people criticize that, and again, asking, hey, you're a DC insider, you saw behind the curtain, what do you think? I tell them, just like you said, I think our founders were inspired, and I think there's some spiritual aspects. I think they got some help in seeing and understanding the future of this nation and built that in as features to our form of government and our constitution. And I've told them, you know, you criticize the dysfunction of Congress and politicians and the federal interagency. So knowing that, would you want them to be able to act and make snap legislative decisions and enactments?
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely not.
It's good that it's deliberative and that you have to fight to get anything through. Because if they could act with impunity, they would pile up the laws and legislation and the oppression that would come from that, you know, on business, the economy, personal freedoms and things like that. So it's good they have to fight to get anything done in DC. Let them, but let's restrict it to them.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Keep it in that AOR. Don't fight that war on our turf in my house or my neighborhood, you know.
Exactly. All right. So getting towards the end of our chat, when we look at things and from our previous discussions and things we're going to talk about today, you said you like to talk about it and you've said it before, and I agree with you, and like the data is out there. The Air Force we have today is smaller size-wise, number of aircraft, platforms, things like that, than it was in the Army Air Corps when it transitioned from the Army Air Forces to the Air Forces to the Air Force back in 47. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? What are the pros and cons of when everyone says we're smaller than we've ever been in the history of the Air Force? Okay, now what? What does that mean today, kind of in this great power competition?
We need the exquisite technology. And we need the mass. And I don't think it's a binary decision. I think we can have both with the economic might and technological might of this nation. There's no reason we can't have everything we need and as much of it as we need. And again, the common barrier to that is it's politics and political choices and how we spend our discretionary revenue for the United States, right? So we're throwing money at things that don't further the mission and the national security of this nation, that suit, you know, different political factions and constituencies and things like that. But it's wasted money and it's throwing good money after bad. So we need both mass and the best technology out there and put it in the hands of warfighters. And, you know, like you said, the size. So another pretty eye-watering statistic that I heard, I did some reading up recently. I was just appointed to be on the board of directors of the Utah Aerospace Foundation. So the Hill Air Force Base Aerospace Museum. I'm on their board now, and I didn't want to be the dumbest new guy on the board. And so I was looking up the history, and Hill Air Force Base at one time was the depot for F-84 fighters. And there were F-84s across the Air Force in the late 50s and early 60s. And at their peak, there were more F-84s just in Strategic Air Command. So one model, one MDS in one MAGCOM, we had more of than we have total aircraft in the U.S. Air Force inventory today. All kinds, fighters, bombers, tankers, helicopters, everything. That's incredible. Now that's incredible. Why we won the Cold War, right? We were always afraid of and concerned with the Warsaw Pact's mass because they outmassed us in on the ground and in the air and everything. But we had a technological advantage and we had a doctrinal and political advantage as well as economic. So we outspent them and we outfreedomed the Warsaw Pact, and that's why they dissolved and went away. But we presumed that when that happened, we could completely discard the idea of mass, right? Because we were only going to fight these little exquisite battles against terrorists and things like that. In the meantime, our our pacing threat has built up the mass that they presume we need and has outpaced us. And if you look at the vector they're on, that China is on, again, it's stunning how much mass they will have in just a few short years. And we're still struggling to field B-21s.
Yeah.
And 35s and sixth-gen fighters and KC-46s and everything like that. And I think, you know, again, this is open source, but we don't not only have enough tankers for ongoing, you know, quote, peacetime CONUS missions and things like that. We don't even have enough tankers to support any one combatant command's OPLANs, right? And yet we're retiring KC-10s and we can't maintain KC-135s because the industrial base is fragile and has crumbled. And, you know, we could do an hour just on defense industrial base, which I got to work on defense industrial base policy both times that I was at the Pentagon.
And maybe we will.
Absolutely, absolutely one of my passions and has led me to what I'm doing now as a consultant and advisor now that I'm in the private sector, is to be part of that solution in ways that I couldn't when I was in uniform. We need the best technology, absolutely. And it's only going to come from this nation because of our politics, because of the kind of society we have, because of our value on STEM and knowledge and those exquisite capabilities. But we need the mass to go with it. And that's less palatable because you hear people saying, well, we've got all these social programs we need to fund and we need to take care of people in our own borders and everything. Well, without national security and a functioning deterrent military, we don't, those programs are the least of our worries for sure. So we can do both, but you need to measure some of those other things in favor of providing better deterrence, stronger national defense and the national security we need.
It's interesting, like what we talk about is like the mass, like the tenets of warfare seem to be lost on some of our civilian leadership, even potentially some of our uniform leadership, where mass and maneuver. And it's like it's hard to outmaneuver overwhelming mass. And so when you're looking at some of those things, like if somebody else is just gonna outmass you, and then you try to execute maneuver and attrition warfare against that, like that's going to be a difficult proposition. So I like what you're saying about mass, and that's a huge tenet of warfare. So last question, you were a general officer in the Pentagon. Let's pretend that the Republic is different. And right now you could have made one last decision on your last day in uniform that was going to permeate and have the biggest impact that you see going forward in the military. What would that decision have made, or what policy would you have instituted?
That's a tough choice. But I'll pick one that I'm knowledgeable and passionate about. And those are probably the things you should talk about, right? As a lifelong Air Force reserve, as part of the reserve component, but who got to do traditional active duty, regular component jobs for most of my career and got to have that kind of role and influence, the willful ignorance of what the reserve component, the Air Force Reserve, the Air National Guard brings to the capability of this nation is the most disappointing thing. And it's a choice. I say willful ignorance because the total force policy for the Department of Defense was signed in 1973, Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, right? But even before then, we had reserve components of all the services, and they were used in war from World War I on. And in fact, before that, we were a militia nation. It's the history and heritage of this country that people were farmers and lawyers and shopkeepers, and then they picked up arms to fight this nation's battles and win them, and then they went back to their civilian life, you know, their public life. And it's only a feature since World War II that we've had a large standing active duty force. And again, that's in response to the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union, the persistent technology that we've had with nuclear weapons and, you know, electronics and everything that have allowed persistent surveillance and the space race and all those kind of things necessitated rightfully that we have a standing active duty force and that it grew over time. But now, again, politics and economics play into it. And we will never be able to afford an active duty force that services all the missions and provides all the capability we need for the defense of this nation and its deterrence and for national security, which leaves us with only one conclusion. Some of our force will be part-time in the reserve component. And yet there are, again, political, territorial factions that have neglected and negated the ability for the reserve component to be the represent the capability that they do to the defense of this nation. And it's often just petty political, again, insecurities and territorialism, right?
Yeah.
And so, but if you look at the economics and you look at the actual data that's available on the capability, the readiness of the reserve component, you can have all the deterrence, all the military capability on call, and have the right proportion of it in the reserve component. And organizations like yours, the 466th Fighter Squadron, the 419th Fighter Wing, whether or not you're in an association with the 388th and the regular component, is undervalued and underutilized. And I saw it, again, these cultural biases in the Air Force and the Department of Defense. As the maintenance group commander at March Field, I had a 8 PAA C-17 squadron with 9 C-17s assigned. And with everything going on around the globe, those things should be in the air or on the ground at some intermediate stop all the time. And yet there were many, many days we had 7 of them sitting on the ramp at March because Air Mobility Command wouldn't call them up and use them. So they'd wear out Travis or McGuire or McCord or Charleston or any of those other, you know, the regular component C-17 bases. But our reserve unit equipped C-17s were underutilized while they complained about not having enough airlift capacity. And that sort of mindset and those actions permeate our Air Force. So if I could make one change, it would be to force Congress to hold the military services accountable for the capability that we've invested in hardware and in personnel, and actually adequately and properly use those and be the deterrent capability that we need as a nation. So
I love that.
And it's not for lack of perfect. Talking like, about it and striving to educate. I mean, I had audiences with Chief of Staff of the Air Force almost every day, occasionally the Secretary of the Air Force. And it just, you couldn't get those folks to understand and change their mind.
Well, yeah, that's that. Like I said, that speaks to my heart as a reservist, and I don't disagree with you as kind of that piece of it. And then getting people on status, off status. It's so hard to provide the strategic depth that we are tasked to provide, and it definitely should not be as difficult as it is, and it shouldn't be as kind of shunned or territorial as it currently is. And I like what you said there.
And some of that isn't any sort of, you know, political or territorial bias. It's just the oppression of the bureaucracy, because a program like DTS, right, the defense travel system, is agnostic to components, missions, anything like that. And we lack the will to fix that. Do you think pick any major industrial organization in the private sector, they would never tolerate inflicting DTS on their people. They'd fix it. They'd realize that it's a bottom line thing and a quality of life thing. And it wouldn't have gone on as long as it did, but we've invested literally billions in programs like that and not fixed them. Those billions could have bought more F-35s or better pay for military people or better housing or, you know, deterrent capability or capacity or whatever. So we're far too comfortable playing with other people's money and being inefficient with it and irresponsible.
Well, I second that. I agree with that. All right. I'm going to be a good steward of your time. Thank you. Thank you so much for this time. In fact, I like something you said just a little bit ago, leads me to believe that I would like to do a part two with you about the defense industrial base at some other time. So we're going to go ahead and get that scheduled, especially for the folks that I know are probably saying, man, I'd like to hear some more about that. So thank you so much, Stivvy, for your time coming on the show. Last words over to you. I know we're a little bit over time, but last words over to you before we thank our subscribers and then kind of get out of here for the day.
Yeah, the American public should have every faith and confidence in their uniformed service members. And especially I can speak personally among all the branches because I've served in joint assignments, but my home and heart have been in the Air Force for almost four decades. It gave me abundant opportunity, none of which I ever deserved. But I had amazing bosses. I served with amazing airmen, got to take care of, again, America's greatest treasure, their sons and daughters who chose to do this. We are and always will be and need to be the greatest nation that there ever has been. And, even more personally and close to home, this local community here in Utah around Hill Air Force Base, Utah, objectively, I think it was U.S. News and World Report just published their best places to live, and Utah was number one again, objectively the best economy because of fiscal conservatism and just the culture we build around here. There are a lot of templates and models for all the things we need to do. We can fix all of these things as a nation. There are really not a lot of new ideas. We just need to implement them and listen to the people who know and discard politics and do what's best for this great nation. And I'm always have been and will be committed to being part of the solution. And forums like this, great podcasts are a great way to get that word out, to get people thinking and engaged and increase the understanding and hopefully forward the conversation and make things better. So I appreciate knowing you and knowing the work you're doing here and certainly in your other role in uniform as a mighty Lightning pilot, you have my greatest admiration and I'm jealous you get to continue to work with the greatest people in America doing that mission. So thank you. And thanks for your service.
All right. Well, thank you for yours, Stiffy. I appreciate it. Have a great rest of the day. For those listening, thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Afterburn Podcast. Whether it's me or Rain, hosting great guests like Stiffy, hit the subscribe. Thanks to our Patreon supporters. We'll have to do this again sometime, sir. And have a great rest of the day. And thanks for talking. This was eye-opening. It was enlightening to me. And I couldn't be happier getting to know you. So appreciate all the time and the words that you gave us. So have a great rest of the day. And Afterburn, out.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from national public data. You might be asking yourself, what's national public data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background check. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description again to get 14 days free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.